Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Cry from the Far Middle, Dispatches from a Divided Land, by P.J. O'Rourke, read by L.J. Ganser. Publisher's note, this audiobook refers to a modified preamble to the Constitution and quiz included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Steeler's Wheel. Pre-preface. As we go to press. While this book was being written in 2019, America was deep in an era of idiot populism and hooligan partisanship. Our country was engaged in a sort of socio-political Peloponnesian war. That is, we were in the midst of a long, confusing, tedious, useless, foolish conflict that threatened to destroy democracy and left ordinary, commonsensical people feeling, "It's all Greek to me." Then, when this book was being edited and typeset, somebody ate an undercooked bat in a Wuhan wet market. Panic and pandemic ensued. The nation was brought to a stay-at-home standstill, whether reasonably or not, no one is quite certain, and by whose authority no one is quite sure. "It's like being 16 again," a friend of mine said. "Gas is cheap, and I'm grounded." Then, with everyone cooped up, going crazy and going broke, some fuss budget with a loose mutt in Central Park calls 911. "There's an African-American man threatening my life," after being admonished by a Harvard-educated bird watcher, who, if video is anything to go by, is the very picture of a Harvard-educated bird watcher. On the same day as that Central Park display of American inclusiveness and mutual respect, members of the Minneapolis police force decide to take a knee on the neck of George Floyd. After nearly 9 minutes of suffocation, Floyd died. He was accused of spending $20 in the form of a banknote that had no actual value. The U.S. Senate and House of Representatives are currently spending billions of dollars in the form of banknotes that have no actual value. Would the police employ the same bigotry and violence on them? No. All across the country, the police would employ bigotry and violence on people protesting the bigotry and violence of the police. Chaos cried out its appeal. The thievish and the vandalistic are friends of chaos, and when their friend calls, they come. The President of the United States called for peace, understanding, and unity. In a pig's ass, he did. The President waddled down to his bunker hidey hole under the White House and urged the U.S. military to invade the country they live in. Then he talked trash and went to church. He could use it, attacking thousands of nonviolent demonstrators to get there. Not a very Christian way of going to church. That's where things stood as this book made its socially distancing and peacefully protesting way to the printer. All this is to say that my book looks back on an era of troubles that, in retrospect, seem to have been the good old days. And now I, who have covered politics and all its works and all its empty promises for half a century, and who had so very many things to say about them, am left mute. There are people possessed of the expertise necessary to explain, analyze, and make judicious commentary upon the present and future effects of the novel coronavirus. And there are, I suppose, people endowed with the foresight to determine the outcome of the social upheavals accompanying the pandemic. I'm not one of either of them. And the last thing the world needs at the moment is more pundits who don't know what they're talking about. Journalists are supposed to provide answers, but all I've got is questions. Starting with, isn't somebody supposed to be in charge? Too many of America's elected leaders have been acting as if the pandemic is a children's party game, where they're all blindfolded and swinging sticks, except they're clobbering each other instead of the virus pinata. Under microscopic view, coronavirus does look like it would make a swell papier-mâché target full of lethal pathogens. Let's leave the politicians to amuse themselves while we skip this fiesta. Which raises another question about this book itself. Is it now completely beside the point? Will American politics be fundamentally changed by the pandemic? Will Americans emerge from their grievous health crisis, lockdown isolation, economic collapse, and material deprivation with a newly calm, pragmatic, and reasonable attitude toward our political system? Will our reawakened awareness of systemic prejudice cause us to critically analyze and democratically restrain our civil institutions? Will we abandon the factional hysterias and histrionics of the early 21st century in favor of a polity based upon competence, civil discourse, and goodwill? Or will we revert to our petty arguments and stupid animadversions? Having had time alone to dwell on our grievances and affronts, will we maybe even return to our spiteful quarreling with renewed vigor? This is often how human nature works. I'm betting that human nature will triumph over adversity and challenge, and I don't mean that in a good way. PJOR, June 8th, 2020. Preface. Manifesto for Extreme Moderation. A voice of the political far middle. What this country needs is fewer people who know what this country needs. We'd be better off, in my opinion, without so many opinions, especially without so many political opinions, including my own. Our nation faces a multitude of difficult, puzzling, complex, and abstruse problems. Most Americans aren't sure what to do about them. But we lack politicians with the courage to say, "I'm not sure what to do about them either." We even lack politicians with the courage to say, "I'm not sure what abstruse means." Our economy has been upended by technological changes that make the Industrial Revolution look like James Watt putting a bigger tea kettle on a hotter stove. Our second Gilded Age, with its golden pathways across the ether, is a gold brick when it comes to crumbling roads, decaying bridges, rackety public transit, corroding water pipes, and collapsing sewers. A soaring economy has left absurd deprivation in the midst of ridiculous luxury. A click on a website can now deliver everything to everybody, except a living wage. Meanwhile, we're undergoing social changes so swift and profound that they send even the best cultural anthropologist fleeing. A latter-day Margaret Mead would be hiding out in Samoa, hoping like heck to study something as relatively uncomplicated as teenagers. The tic-tac-toe of Cold War diplomacy has given way to the foreign policy conundrums of tri-dimensional chess, like Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock played on the Starship Enterprise, except the pawns have nukes. Transformations in healthcare have turned the historically cheapest part of being alive, dying, into something so expensive that many people can't afford to do it. And surviving Americans are left trying to weigh the delicate balance between having a life worth living and having a planet that can support life. Yet our political leaders all think they know the answer to what is to be done. To quote Vladimir Lenin, a political leader who, among his other faults, flunked his own quiz. The problem with opinions is that they're not synonymous with accomplishing anything. I have three school-age children with strong opinions about climate change, but who can't remember to close the front door in midwinter. The traditional dad line, "We're not heating the outdoors," hasn't worked, so I appeal to their wokeness. That would cause global warming. Then I drag the snowblower in from the garage to clear the front hall. We need a political system that isn't so darn sure of itself. It's time for the rise of the extreme moderate. Power to the far middle. Let's bring the wishy and the washy back together, along with the namby and the pamby and the milk and the toast. The extreme moderate's non-negotiable demand? Negotiation. We won't compromise until we see some compromising. We want political action, or inaction. It depends. And wouldn't it be great if we had an opinion-free news media source? I have the perfect name for it. Happy Medium. We may be on different sides of the fence, but let's make that fence top wider and better padded and go sit on it. Then, no matter if I'm of conservative ilk and you're of liberal stripe, we can have a neighborly chat. Should the government be laissez? Should the government be fair? We're all in favor of peace, but when the wolf dwells with the lamb and the leopard lies down with the kid, how often do we have to replace those sheep and goats? Does Medicare for All mean young people have to wear trifocals and Depends and trade their bicycles for walkers? If taxpayer money is used to pay for political campaigns, do taxpayers have 90 days to return politicians for a full refund? Animal rights are important, but what about animal responsibilities? Does pursuit of happiness mean I can drink before noon? These are all important questions. Let's discuss them while making social justice more sociable. Here, have a nip from my hip flask. We might be able to come to some accommodation with each other's views. If today's political leaders would rather burn the milk toast and ignore the wishes of the wishy-washy, extreme moderates should hang them out with the wash, and they'll be toast. Mixed, metaphorically speaking, of course, because harsh words and rash actions are not our style. Indeed, how to go about being an extreme moderate presents some problems. The kind of things that other extremists do seem so extreme. But I do have one idea. Free speech should not only be protected, it should be compulsory. Everyone with a strong political opinion should be required to wear a sign proclaiming it. Hang an "Immigration is Ruining America" placard around your neck and see how you get treated by restaurant staff, Uber drivers, the people who change your hotel linen, and your immigrant grandparents. Go see your personal physician with "I want the government to run your doctor's office" lettered in magic marker across your abdomen. Sorry, Senator Warren, but it looks like we're going to have to remove your other appendix. Introduction. Oh, beautiful for pilgrim feet? America is in need of some explaining, especially at the moment. That the country is a mess is the one thing the country agrees on. And even about this, we differ. Half the nation seems to be saying, "We don't know what's wrong with America, but we can fix it." While the other half says, "There's nothing wrong with America, and we can fix that." Polarized gaps may be melting, or not. But America's polarization is frozen solid, and if the climate itself is a contentious issue, then we cannot so much as agree on what the weather's like outside. Everything is much more wrong than it ever was, and we are much more right about it. We're all mad at each other and incensed that others are furious with us. It's a sort of permanent anti-Christmas, an obligatory holiday exchange where we're bound to receive umbrage and compelled to give offense. Everybody's got a beef, except the vegans. They've got a Beyond Meat. To tally our national complaints would be to empty a bathtub with a spoon, and after this long and sodden labor, we'd find some new tangle of comb-over hairs in the political drain or ring of scum on the social porcelain that we hadn't thought to complain about before. It is confusion. And, lest this most general of statements escape bitter contention, the previous sentence was trigger warning, or is trigger warning an implicit denial of Second Amendment rights? A quotation from the Bible, Leviticus 18:23, forbidding sex with animals. Further topics for Twitter storms. Is Leviticus 18:23 blatant anthropocentrism or a swipe left on Tinder? Does Leviticus also forbid sex with plant protein-based beef substitutes, even when they are free from GMOs, soy, and gluten? Is posting the gluten content in communion wafers a threat to religious freedoms? We have worked ourselves into a state of angry perplexity. Not that this is anything new. America was discovered with angry perplexity. In 1524, a perplexed Giovanni da Verrazzano, an Italian explorer serving the King of France by mapping what would become British colonies, mistook the shallow waters west of North Carolina's Outer Banks for the Pacific Ocean. Subsequent navigators, finding the dunes of Cape Hatteras rather than the riches of the Orient, were angry. And America was founded in angry perplexity, starting with the first attempt to colonize the nation, on those outer banks, at the lost colony of Roanoke. The people who already lived on Roanoke Island The Croatoan and the Dasamongweponk were perplexed when 115 English arrived uninvited in 1587. Angry, too. Within a few days, the Dasamongweponk had killed one of the English, George Howe. Within a few more days, the English had killed several of the Croatoan who'd had nothing to do with Howe's death. Thus, a precedent was set for the way different kinds of Americans would treat each other for the next 400-some years, and what would happen to innocent bystanders when the treatment was being handed out. Advice to American bystanders: don't stand by, stand back. Any number of horrifying examples can be cited. From the first colonial legislation, legally recognizing slavery, in 1641, in enlightened, nominally pro-emancipation Massachusetts, to the Battle of Wounded Knee, in 1890. Several hundred Lakota casualties, mostly women, children, and old men, to the chokehold killing of Eric Garner in Staten Island in 2014. He died after being apprehended by police for selling loose cigarettes in violation of New York's strict legislation to limit the harmful effects of tobacco. I quote the late Christopher Hitchens, "History is a tragedy and not a morality tale." But the precedent the Roanoke colonists thought they were setting was more like the gentrification of Brooklyn. Not that innocent bystanders haven't been harmed in Bushwick, priced out of their humble abodes so that craft kombucha brewers, aspiring mobile app developers, Anasura yoga practitioners, and indie musicians who drive part-time for Uber could move in. Traveling to Roanoke in 1587 were 89 men, 17 women, and 9 children, including, we must assume, at least a couple of adolescents muttering, "This sucks." They were Londoners, tradesmen, artisans, and their families. The venture was a 16th-century version of a real estate investment trust. The REIT had a charter from Queen Elizabeth that formed a corporation headed by Sir Walter Raleigh, comfortably back in England. The colonists hoped to become genteel, to attain the status of landed gentry, although the gentleman managing the scheme, the governor of the Roanoke colony, John White, was a member of the gentry by virtue of being a celebrated watercolor artist. As far as scholars can tell, the colonists had estate management skills and agricultural expertise about equal to indie musicians in Brooklyn. Or not even, given the musicians' cannabis grow rooms. And while Roanoke Colony did become a gated community after George Howe was killed, there were no provisions for organized security or defense. Besides not getting along with their new neighbors, in whose backyards they were camping, the colonists had angry perplexities of their own. The expedition was so poorly provisioned that within a month of their arrival, the colonists petitioned Governor White to return to England for more supplies. He didn't get back until 3 years later. Some things came up. A 1588 relief mission was distracted by a side hustle in privateering and a fight with French pirates near Morocco, which to a modern sailor with GPS would be very much in the wrong direction from North Carolina. Then there was the Spanish Armada. Seafaring watercolor artists were needed on the home front. When the governor of the Roanoke colony finally landed back on Roanoke Island, his colony was gone. All that was left was an abandoned palisade with the word Croatoan carved on a post. White took this to mean that the colonists had moved to the nearby island called Croatoan, or perhaps had made some Airbnb arrangements with the Croatoans, who were friendly to the English. Or they had been friendly until they were mistaken for Dasamongweponks and killed. Maybe Croatoans were friendly again. White meant to go find out. But some other things came up. One of his ships wanted to go home. The other broke an anchor cable and was blown so far off course, with White aboard, that it came ashore in the Azores. As long as his Roanoke colonists were not proven to be dead, Sir Walter Raleigh could maintain his corporate claim on what was loosely called Virginia, everything on the continent north of Spanish Florida. This may cast doubt on the complete sincerity of Raleigh's claim to have been trying to find them on his 1595 voyage to the New World, while he was also searching for El Dorado. No other major effort to locate the Roanoke colonists was made until after the Jamestown colony was established in 1607, and by then there was no trace. No one knows what happened to the residents of the Lost Colony. I think that, full of angry perplexity, they stomped off in a huff. Which set another precedent for America. People do not emigrate because things are going well at home. This was true for ancient migrants from Asia 20,000 years ago, or 30,000 years ago, or 40,000 years ago. There is fractious conflict about that, too. Geologists, paleontologists, archaeologists, and anthropologists turn out to be as polarized as the rest of us. Fortunately, their lengthy scientific terms pretty much keep their angry perplexities from being aired on Twitter. Nonetheless, there was some time when some people headed over the Bering Strait land bridge, waving farewell. See you later, you frozen Siberians with your itchy, woolly, mammoth-long underwear and mastodon meat on your breath. We're off to the beautiful Pacific Northwest. Waterfront property, split-level longhouses, decorative totem pole lawn ornaments, and salmon frying on the barbecue grill. Then, midst weekend sightseeing jaunts to watch the glaciers retreat and hunting trips to bag soon-to-be-extinct trophy megafauna, they proceeded to have their own Roanoke Colony moments. Never mind that there wasn't anybody else already living in the New World to quarrel with. In November 2015, National Geographic published an article by Glenn Hodges, First Americans, detailing new finds, theories, and genetic discoveries about the populating of the Western Hemisphere. Given the current animosity surplus, I'm sure somebody's mad at National Geographic, too, because of cultural appropriation, or because you have to be a member of the National Geographic Society to get the magazine, so this is probably a secret society, maybe funded by George Soros, or because an old dead white male had accumulated 30 years of back issues in the attic, and these fell through the kitchen ceiling on the heads of the flip or flop TV crew, or something. Anyway, the article said, if you look at the skeletal remains of Paleo-Americans, more than half of the men have injuries caused by violence, and 4 out of 10 have skull fractures. The wounds don't appear to have been the result of hunting mishaps, and they don't bear telltale signs of warfare like blows suffered fleeing an attacker. Instead, it appears that these men fought among themselves, often and violently. The women don't have these kinds of injuries, but they're much smaller than the men, with signs of malnourishment and domestic abuse. Nor did the post-Roanoke Europeans find America to be a day at the beach, although George Howe was in fact having a day at the beach, gathering crabs, when the Dasamongwepong shot him full of arrows. Unlike the 1587 Lost Colony's ex-residents, the 1607 Jamestown colonists weren't seeking status, just money. Their flight from impoverishment in England amounted to a lethal version of a 1930s Warner Brothers animated cartoon gag. Deprivation chased the colonists around the barn of poverty, and they ran so hard and heedlessly that they collided with deprivation's backside. Of the 500-some colonists who arrived in Jamestown between 1607 and 1610, 440 of them died, mostly from starvation. The initial settlers landed too late in the year to plant crops, and didn't know much about planting anyway. Their only piece of good fortune was not being immediately evicted by the local landlords, the Powhatan Confederacy. This was an organization of about 30 Algonquian-speaking tribes that had formed a military alliance against Siouan-speaking tribes to their north and west under the leadership of Wahun Senecaw, father of Pocahontas. The Powhatan were well aware of the 3 rules of real estate. None of them lived on the location, location, location of Jamestown. The peninsula on the James River at the mouth of Chesapeake Bay was mosquito-infested, too swampy for farming or hunting, and wetland, though it may have been, suffering a drought that left the colonists nothing to drink but brackish river water. Having mentioned Pocahontas, we might pause to consider what we can learn about the founding of America from one of the few pre-foundational Americans that we know something about. Except we don't know anything about her, starting with her real name, which was Matoaka, unless it was Amanute. She either saved the life of John Smith, one of the Jamestown expedition's original leaders, or she didn't. She may have been participating in an adoption ritual where her father pretended to club Smith on the head. She may not have been there at all. Smith didn't mention her in his first account of being captured by Wahun Senecal. Smith's stories about Pocahontas are inconsistent. He seems to be making them up as he goes along. We're told in early histories of Jamestown that as a child, Pocahontas sometimes visited the colony and was acquainted with John Smith. John Smith? John White? The early history of America reads like the guest register at a shady motel. In 1613, after the English and the Powhatan had had a falling out, Pocahontas was in turn captured, more like kidnapped, by the colonists. Perhaps she had Stockholm Syndrome, or a sadder story. She converted to Christianity, took yet another name, Rebecca, married colonist John Rolfe, and had a son, Thomas. Rolfe took her and Thomas to England, where she was a minor celebrity. Something short of a Wallace Simpson, but considered more presentable to a king. And she was presented to King James. She lived near London for most of a year. In the one portrait of her rendered from life, she looks a bit dour. Probably the weather. Then, after getting on board a ship back to Virginia with her husband and son, she became ill and died at Gravesend, aged 20 or 21. Thomas survived, wed the daughter of a wealthy Virginia landowner, and had a daughter who married a Colonel Robert Bowling. A number of prominent Virginia families, including that of Woodrow Wilson's wife, Edith, née Bowling, claimed descent from Pocahontas. So, we learn that American racism is, at least, topped by descended from a princess snobbery. Pocahontas was the Meghan Markle of her day. Other than that, we learn nothing. We might as well have watched the very stupid 1995 Disney movie. The Jamestown colonists did not arrive with the equipment, supplies, or inclination to found a self-sustaining colony. The Jamestown business model was to export valuable commodities, but they couldn't find any. They shipped a load of clabbered to England. The London investors who had funded Jamestown were not best pleased. They sent a stiff note, along with their 1608 inadequate resupply of the colony. According to the historian James Horn, preeminent expert on Jamestown, the investors insisted that the colonists send them enough goods to pay for the cost of the resupply voyage, plus a lump of gold, proof that the South Sea had been discovered, and somebody from the lost colony of Roanoke, and a partridge in a pear tree. Jamestown would go down in history, and down was the direction it was headed, for many American firsts. The kind of firsts you wish America hadn't had. The poorest among the Jamestown colonists were the first to condemn themselves to indentured servitude to pay for their trip to America. Their terms of bondage ranged from 3 to 7 years, but it was mostly death rather than time served that released them from their debt. To add evil to iniquity, the first abducted Africans known to have been transported to British America were sold as slaves in Jamestown in 1619. The same year brought America's first politicking and America's first elected assembly, Jamestown's Virginia House of Burgesses. The legislative body was founded to establish one equal and uniform government over all Virginia, with just laws for the happy guiding and governing of the people there inhabiting. Although to hell with the happy guiding of the Powhatan and every other un-English-born, un-male, un-free, un-Jamestown colony resident on the continent north of Spanish Florida. They weren't part of the electorate. Also that same year, Jamestown experienced America's first strike. The colony included a number of artisans who hadn't been born in England. They seemed to have been the only artisans the colony possessed. They included a soap maker, a timber crafter, and a glass blower. They went on strike for the right to vote. And it may have been America's first, and last, quick and amiable settlement between organized labor and management. Dirty Englishmen sitting under sagging roof beams, drinking out of cupped hands, immediately granted artisans the franchise. The House of Burgesses legislated as wisely as American legislatures continue to do. That is, making laws that
Sample complete. Ready to continue?